across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there, we really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast. The Stephen Nolan Show!
Have I heard that story right there in the news? That after 2 years of consultants and Stormont knowing about it, they can't fix a footpath. They can't work out how you walk along a footpath. Have I actually heard that right? In our city centre, they can't work out how someone walks along a footpath safely. Have I actually heard that right? If you've been down that area, if you're a local business in that area, maybe you want to give us a ring this morning, 03030 80 55 55. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Our top story today: questions are being raised by the DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, over whether enough is being done to prosecute members of the IRA who he says escaped an army ambush in Tyrone in 1992. Yesterday, a coroner who ruled SAS soldiers were unjustified when they killed four IRA men in Clonoe referred his findings to the Director of Public Prosecutions. Gavin Robinson wants to know if the suspected IRA members will also be pursued in the courts. The late Seamus Mallon, of course, of the SDLP, called the killings tragic. When he was speaking at the time, he wanted to be sure minimum force had been used, but he said there is a question for the IRA.
When are those who are encouraging violence and giving young men guns and putting them out to engage in acts of violence, when are they going to have the courage and the honesty to tell them that it is going nowhere, that it is counterproductive, that it is doing harm to the community, not least the people who support them, and to call it all off? That is the message that must come in this and in every other type of fatal incident in the north of Ireland. And the more that message is given to them, the more those men are going to have to defend the indefensible.
The DUP MLA, Jonathan Buckley, is with me this morning. Morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the former SDLP MLA, Alban McGuinness. Good morning, Alban.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. So, Jonathan, set this out for us, what your party is saying this morning.
Well, I suppose, Stephen, from the outset, that this particular case about Clonoe has caused considerable hurt in our community, not just to those veterans who feel that, again, the history has been rewritten to essentially put them in the dock and criticise them for actions that they took in some very, very difficult circumstances. It's also caused considerable hurt to many IRA victims who feel that, again, the point of focus is on those that protected our community as opposed to those that set out with lethal intent. And what my leader is trying to point out, particularly in this referring of the case to the DPP, is that within the coroner's report, there is a number of individuals. Now, we do not know their names. There's ciphers that are attributed and their identities protected. But at the time, four terrorists were killed. Three were convicted, and we know that three went on the run. Now, security reports at the time show that the three on the run, they believe, were lifted in Monaghan in terms of by the Garda. And when they were lifted by the Garda, they'd two of them had bullet wounds and essentially were questioned by police. But we have no evidence to suggest that they were in any way convicted or charged with anything in relation to what happened at Clonoe. Mm-hmm. But here, when we look at the coroner's report, those individuals were questioned by the coroner. So I suppose what Gavin is trying to establish, and indeed what the DUP are trying to establish, is were there anything that suggests that these individuals were prosecuted at any time in the Irish state where they were lifted, or indeed were the Secretary of State aware of any of their involvement? Because this cannot be continually looked through the lens of one particular actor. I'm very clear, and indeed the DUP is very clear, the SAS acted justly. They protected our community, and I believe we as a community are very fortunate that for the actions of the SAS and indeed other British Army personnel in Northern Ireland essentially saved lives and protected lives.
Are you talking generally about the SAS? Are you including this incident
in your praise for the SAS?
Well, I'm particularly looking at this instance in terms of the coroner's report. So, but I know indeed in many other instances where the SAS engaged with IRA terrorists, who the report suggests, by the way, were on active duty. Were the SAS engaged with those terrorists, they left Northern Ireland a safer place.
Jonathan, you are selectively quoting from this report. What you're leaving out is that Mr. Justice Humphreys, Northern Ireland's presiding coroner, he's a judge. He said the use of lethal force cannot be reasonable. He said there was no attempt to arrest the four IRA men, even as they lay on the ground wounded. And he said that state agencies had perpetuated falsehoods. They pretended there had been a gun battle when there wasn't. The IRA men had not fired on the soldiers, despite the British state making that up. And you're praising the SAS, who what? Were part and parcel of making up a gun battle and shooting men as they lay on the ground rather than arresting them. So does your party believe in truth? Does your party believe that people should be arrested rather than killed as they lie on the ground? And does your party believe in the rule of law?
Yes, my party believes in truth, justice and the rule of law, which many parties have fallen short of over many years, including those that have praised the
actions. This is Justice Humphreys we're talking about
here. So let's look at it, Stephen. Why were the SAS in Clonoe that day? Why? Come on, you've read the report, obviously. Why were the SAS men in Clonoe that day, Stephen?
They were there because they had intelligence that the IRA were going to be there.
They had intelligence that an IRA unit of the brutal East Tyrone Brigade had acquired an anti-aircraft gun, one of the most elaborate pieces of weaponry in the IRA arsenal, a piece of weaponry that has the potential to not only take down aircraft. We know that many of our armed forces were travelling about the province at that time via aircraft. A piece of weaponry that had the potential to take huge life. So when the SAS were at Clonoe that day and came into direct contact with the provisional IRA, I believe, and indeed when I read the report, and I respect Justice Humphrey, you know, he is an eminent legal professional, but when I look at the coroner's findings, I also read the reports at the time from the soldiers, all of whom felt that their life was under threat. And I mean, whenever a lorry that pulls into a car park that has welded to it an anti-aircraft gun with men in the back with AK-47s, indeed, Stephen, you can only imagine, if you put yourself into the context at the time, it was, in a sense, soldiers that were defending themselves whenever they felt that perhaps those individuals could not be arrested. But I think the focus on this one has to be...
How can someone lying on the ground, wounded, not be arrested?
Well, we don't know. Whenever I read the report and look at the individual soldiers' testimonies from the time, and that's all we can really go with on this one. You know, there were soldiers in different positions. In fact, whenever we look at the ballistic report, which is covered over in page or paragraph 300 of the report and after, Mrs. Kernan, who was the ballistics expert, could not also provide conclusive proof that there was no bullets fired from those AK-47s as well. So I think, you know, we are allowed to look at this, and it deserves the examination of all of its elements. And when we look particularly at those three individuals that went on the run, what is the DPP going to do to ensure that they're held accountable? Because there is a war that's being raged against our armed forces, Stephen. I think, look at this from the very beginning. The three people that were convicted got a 3-year suspended sentence. In 2011, one of the getaway drivers was awarded £75,000 from the government for being shot at the time. I think this is a corruption of justice. And the revisionist history must not be allowed to distort the reality of the troubles or vilify those who serve to protect the public.
Alban? It's a fair question, isn't it?
Well,
how come those who actually went out with the intent to kill and maim and had machine guns or whatever they are on that lorry, how come anti-aircraft guns. How come they should not be pursued? Like, how does that make sense?
Well, first of all, this is not a revisionist history that, as claimed by previous speaker. This is the conclusion of a judge who heard evidence over many, many weeks, heard evidence in detail, forensic evidence, witness evidence, etc., etc. This is a very detailed conclusion by the judge, and I don't think that it serves the interests of justice, or indeed serves the interests of politics at large, to, as it were, second-guess what the judge has concluded. And I think it's very important for us to respect that this is an independent process which a High Court judge has embarked upon as a coroner for Northern Ireland, chief coroner.
Well,
and
except,
he has brought his expertise to bear on this.
And, except Alban McGuinness, as you very well know, the judge was not asked to look at whether the IRA men, whether files should be sent to the DPP for their actions. So it's not that he didn't think they should. He wasn't asked to look at that.
Let me deal with that point. First of all, this will be, all of this will be looked at by the DPP. I'm sure Mr. Stephen Hearn is a very able individual, and he is totally independent. And he will look at all of the evidence independently once again. And he will do that through the good offices of the Commission for Reconciliation and Information Recovery, because they are charged with, as it were, reassembling the evidence and looking at everything afresh and giving guidance to the DPP in order that the DPP can make his decision in relation to prosecution of the military personnel who were involved in this incident. Now, that is headed by the former Lord Chief Justice, Sir Declan Morgan, himself a respected and distinguished jurist and truly independent. And nobody can second-guess him. Nobody can undermine his integrity in this. And so
Alban,
it's very important.
It's not about that, is it? This is about everybody today, whether they're schooled in legal matters or they're a plumber or an electrician, a hairdresser or whatever. This is about how do you think it just smells and feels that people who go out with the intent to kill security forces, no prosecution, no file sent for consideration to the DPP, but the soldiers who could have been killed, what the intent would have been, if they could have, presumably to kill them, and the police officers inside that police station, and the men and civilians inside that police station at the time, which had been attacked, no files to the DPP around that, and just the British state forces brought to account. How does that look to you? How does that feel to you?
No, look, I do not side with the IRA in this case or in any other case where they were going out of their way to attack security forces or anybody else. I do not sympathise with them. I take the view that Seamus Mallon expressed in that clip that you've just quoted from, that the IRA were responsible for sending these young men out, and these young men were going nowhere. And what they were doing was counterproductive. And as I said in your program last week, this was a tragedy, a total tragedy for everybody involved in it. The IRA men, their families, the whole community, and indeed for the soldiers who have to live with the consequences of their actions as well.
Jonathan Buckley, can I just test this? Are you saying, are you glad those IRA men were killed, whereas the coroner feels they could have been arrested or an attempt should have been made to arrest them? Are you glad they were killed otherwise?
Well, I don't take glee in anybody's death, but I absolutely believe that the SAS were totally justified in this instance. I mean, Stephen, many times on your program, and indeed in Northern Ireland, there is legitimate reason for people of all communities to question what happened to their loved ones. And I think actually the testimonies of those involved in the Omagh bomb and some of the coverage that you had yesterday bears testimony to that. were, did the state act in an appropriate way to prevent such a brutal bomb that killed and took so many innocent lives? But this is not one of them. These men sat out with lethal intent. I think anybody that knows any of the history of East Tyrone IRA Brigade, in fact, many Republican books point to the fact that the regiment and the brigade in itself had become so detached from the wider IRA army council in terms of their rogue operators. These were men that were set out with lethal intent. I think I explained it in the Assembly Chamber the year before in 1991. My great-uncle, Lance Corporal Bobby Crozier, was killed when a bomb was rolled, an IRA, provisional IRA bomb was rolled down the side of the hill, killing him and his colleagues instantly. There was no justice. There was no inquiry. There was no calls for inquiry. Just an empty seat at a dinner table. And I think whenever we look at this, and anybody with any form of rational thinking looks at this, you know, the charge is always placed against the SAS that there was a shoot to kill policy. Well, I would argue, given the expertise of the SAS, that if it was a shoot to kill policy, that all 10 IRA men would have been killed that day. In fact, people don't want to even harbour on the fact that there was one individual that was in the car park that was wounded. He was actually receiving medical treatment by the SAS and then brought to the hospital. I think we have to put this in context of the time that it was in. These men were in place to protect human life. And I certainly am thankful for
their
actions.
They didn't do a very good job of it, did they, in terms of the IRA men?
No, Stephen, that's not fair. They didn't do a good job of it. Do we know, for example, let's look at the Oma bomb, for example. Imagine if the same SAS man had have intercepted those cold-blooded terrorists and killed them before they had planted the bomb in Oma.
But Jonathan, why does it not matter?
Hold on, let me finish the point. Would we be looking at them in the same cold light that we're looking at these soldiers that were involved with Clonoe? Absolutely not. Get this into perspective.
So
these
how do you...
You
say
lethal
that...
intent.
You say that, Jonathan, that you respect Mr. Justice Humphreys. You acknowledge his experience and expertise. And he has said that the use of lethal force cannot have been reasonable. He has said there was no attempt to arrest the four IRA men, even as they lay wounded. What? He said the operation was not planned and controlled in such a way as to minimise to the greatest extent possible the need for recourse to lethal force. And he said the state agencies had perpetuated falsehoods, having claimed at the time there'd been a gun battle. They made it up.
Well, Stephen, I can disagree. I can respect a judge's eminence, but also disagree with their findings, and I disagree fundamentally.
Well, what bit are you disagreeing
findings.
With?
Well, the fact being that in every soldier's testimony, they talk about the poor lack of cover that they had where they were sitting and where they were positioned. They talked about seeing a lorry coming in with lights to the front and the back. Some believe they were opened up on by those within the lorry. And therefore, that they took action. They took action to save life. And, you know, you talk about positions within the report. You know, paragraph 200 of the report details Detective Superintendent Hart's determination at the time. And she concluded at that stage that the type of weaponry possessed by the terrorists and the total lack of protection for the members of the security forces involved, the use of firearms was the minimal force necessary in light of the very real threat to life. He therefore recommended no prosecution of any of the soldiers involved in the killing of the four deceased. So, you know, that is evidence of the time as well. Now, that is called into question by Justice Humphreys and indeed others, but I don't call into question that testimony. I don't call into question the testimony of those soldiers that were putting themselves in harm's way to protect life.
So
it's very, very easy for armchair generals now to go out of their way to question the actions of those that tried to uphold the law.
Alban, do you think the IRA members who were engaged in violent premeditated attacks and were prepared to kill, do you think they should be brought to justice today?
Well, if there's evidence that pertaining to the individuals that that Jonathan has suggested, then yes, their position should be looked at. But my understanding, and I could be incorrect or incomplete, my understanding is that three were in fact prosecuted and eventually received suspended sentences for individual offences. Now, if there are others that come into that category, then certainly there should be an examination of what they did. But this is quite separate from the current position in relation to the soldiers, where the judge has come to an independent conclusion. Now, the judge looks at the evidence, hears the evidence, assesses the forensics, assesses the overall situation, and comes to a conclusion on the balance of probabilities. He's not he cannot determine a full criminal intent in all of this. I just want to finish this point. All he can do is to refer the matter to the DPP. And the DPP again, will look at this on the basis of beyond reasonable doubt.
It is so important in Northern Ireland, isn't it, that the public feel that there is equality in all different walks of life, but also justice, and the public are not stupid.
Yes.
So I wonder how any reasonable person would be thinking today. And by the way, I'm not being biased in that question because I don't know. I genuinely wonder. Mm-hmm. I guess it depends on their age, their background, their political persuasion. But Gavin Robinson says the following: Aidan McKeever, the IRA getaway driver, got a 3-year suspended sentence and £75,000 compensation because he was shot. So he was a getaway driver.
Yes.
£75,000 because he was shot. Does that feel right to you? Does that feel like justice to you?
To the average citizen, no, it doesn't feel like justice. But again, you have to look at the circumstances in which this man was in fact shot. And you have to look at his involvement at that particular time. Now, the judge in the case, judging that individual case for being wounded, obviously came to a conclusion, and he believed that, given the full circumstances, that he was entitled to that award. Now, I didn't hear that case. I'm not aware of the individual evidence in that case, but certainly people will say, yes, he got a lot of money in that situation. I can understand their concern, but I also have to respect the views of the judge and his determination in that case.
And Jonathan Buckley, Mr. McKeever, was unarmed.
I think this goes to the heart of the perverse imbalance of justice. So he was an IRA getaway driver that day, so it was on the scene. He wasn't there for no reason, Stephen. So I think for many in the public, they'll question the fact being that here we have, again, most, and you talk about, I'm being selective in this report, most of the media coverage in relation to this findings was all focused upon the actions of the security forces of the SAS regiment. But yet here we have an instance where, again, a 3-year suspended sentence, £75,000 in compensation for being shot when you were the getaway driver for a heavily armed IRA terrorist gang. I mean, it is the perverse imbalance of justice through things like this that is calling into question for many where the focus now is in the state. Like, I'm not a weapons expert, Stephen. None of us are in this program.
But four soldiers shot Jonathan, Aidan McKeever shot Adam while he was in that car, firing 15 bullets. He was unarmed.
Stephen, why was Aidan McKeever in that car park? Tell me. I don't think anybody.
Well, he pleaded guilty to assisting offenders. That's what he did.
Correct. Yes. So here's the point. When so-called soldiers were met with real soldiers, I mean, they were engaged in combat, And ultimately, what we have seen here is the demonization of those that were there to protect the state and to protect life. I think this case in itself goes to the very heart of how there is a deep imbalance setting in how our history is being viewed, and indeed how those are using legal routes to demonize those within the security forces. And it is imperative that we ensure that the record is set straight. Like, if this particular, if the objective for the SAS had it been to secure this anti-aircraft gun, and we can understand why that would have been so important given how lethal that particular weapon may have been. Just the report actually shows that in the clip, the magazine clip, that there was bullets that were in that clip. Now, not in the barrel of the gun, but certainly in the clip. Just imagine the carnage if that anti-aircraft gun had been opened up on the soldiers. I mean, would we be sitting talking today about the loss of many SAS personnel in Clonoe? And would those that are so uptight in terms of the actions of the state be looking upon the life lost of those SAS personnel in the same light? I don't think so.
Maybe you can both stay there just for another couple of minutes. We'll pause for a second, take the news at 9:31. Come visit Northern Ireland. Get into the city centre where we're unable to fix a footpath for a couple of years. You couldn't make it up. 0303 80 55 55. DP's Jonathan Buckley staying with us for another few minutes. Alban McGuinness, former SLP, staying with us as well. Paul in Andersonstown. Morning, Paul.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead, Paul.
I'm sitting here listening incredulously to Mr. Buckley. This man talks about revising history. I mean, I doubt whether Jonathan Buckley's actually read the judgment. I doubt very much why he's actually read the judgment.
Sounds like he has. Have you, Jonathan?
All I'm hearing is just imagine in detail. Just imagine the IRA unit did this. Just imagine the IRA unit did this. Just imagine that they did this. The IRA didn't know none of those things that this man's talking about. The IRA never fired a shot at the British soldiers. And that's a fact. It's this complete distortion that we're hearing.
What did they fire into the police station?
Stephen, can you stick to what I'm actually trying to point out?
I'm providing the context.
Everyone accepts the fire into the police station, Stephen.
Right.
That's not in dispute. What I'm talking about here, and what you know fine well, what I'm talking about here is the actions of the British Army in that car park.
Why did they have a heavy machine gun welded to the back of a lorry?
Presumably to fire on the police station.
So are you telling me that you feel that they had the intent to fire indiscriminately into a police station, but if they'd seen soldiers or any other forces of the British state, they would have just turned the weapon away? Is that what you're saying?
Well, Stephen,
there was no danger at all?
Stephen, were you there in the car park?
I'm asking you what you think they would have done with that weapon.
I wasn't, and neither was Jonathan Buckley. The judge heard the evidence. Was the judge
in the car park, Paul?
The judge heard the evidence, Mr. Buckley. The judge heard all the evidence.
Paul, I will say that.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
The IRA themselves came out to say, following the killing of these four terrorists, that they were out on active operation.
That's correct.
Now, what does active operation mean?
Jonathan, listen to me.
Do you know what active operation is?
Well, they just fired into the police station, so of course...
Thank you. Yes. They just fired 60 rounds from an anti-aircraft gun into a police station.
Maybe you're having trouble.
They then went up the road, and they had fired shots again in the air. They then landed into a car park, still on the back of the lorry, with AK-47s in their hand, with somebody still behind an anti-aircraft gun. Now, if you were faced with such lethal force, how would you react?
This is not a laughing matter, Paul.
How would you react?
This is pathetic.
No, sorry, Paul, but your attempt to rewrite the narrative is absolutely pathetic.
In question, No, sorry, Jonathan, I'm not rewriting the narrative. I'm going by what the judge said. I judge by what the judge said, not you. Not you.
I am entitled to read the evidence in the same way that you are, sir. And certainly when I look at this evidence, I suggest that those British Army personnel, in this instance, the SAS regiment, saved many lives by their service day, and indeed many others.
What you're doing. Can I speak?
Of course, go ahead. Yes, absolutely.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that. Thanks very much. What's in question here is how these people were killed. That's what the judge looked at. And you're trying to distort and distract from the judge's findings by putting your own drama on top of every sentence that you speak.
And when you judge. Can I ask this, Paul? When you talk about putting so much stock in how a judge finds a situation, and what a judge says, do you equally put so much stock on how judges have condemned and imprisoned IRA men over the years?
My God.
It's a fair question. Do you always follow and respect what a judge has done and said,
Stephen,
when they've talked about the brutality of the IRA?
Right. Okay. Are you done now? Are you finished? I'm not on here to talk about the generality of the judiciary system, Stephen. I'm talking about this incident.
Right.
Paul,
do you believe it was shit?
Paul, yes, you absolutely can. But that's it's a fair question, isn't it? If you're respecting what a judge says about this incident, I'm asking you, do you respect about what the judiciary has said about the IRA across many incidents?
I'm on this program, this show at the moment.
You're dodging the question.
No, actually, I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm dealing with the issue at hand. I'm not playing your game of distraction. I'm talking about the judgment in this case where men were shot to death while they were on the ground incapacitated. That's the bottom line here. No matter how much Jonathan Buckley wants to revise that and twist it to suit his own narrative.
Paul, may I speak, Paul?
Certainly you can.
Okay. Well, Paul, listen, I, for one thing, you talk about you want to play in distraction, but you're playing in distortion because you make no reference to the fact of what these men were intended to do on that particular night. Can I ask you, do you think there was a shoot-to-kill policy that day?
Absolutely.
You do? Well, why do you think why do you think that only four were killed?
Maybe they were disturbed. Maybe the police turned up. You see, Jonathan...
If you told me that you had looked at this report in detail and you said that maybe the police turned up. But if you look at the detail of the report, you will see that it was quite a time before the police were on the scene. Why there are then four when one person was shot on the scene? Were they receiving first aid treatment from the very SAS soldiers and then transferred to a hospital? Does that sound like a shoot to kill policy to you? Come on, you've read the report.
Was that person shot?
Yes, in the car park.
Well, then maybe they thought that person was dead.
But Paul,
Hold on, please.
I'm not playing this game.
You haven't read the report.
Okay. Hold on one moment. Jonathan Buckley, surely.
Let's not forget that the police will also have questions to answer also.
Okay. Paul, one second. Let me speak, please. Hold on. Jonathan Buckley, you are surely being selective because I have put to you a number of times what was included in this judgment, which was the state agency had perpetuated falsehoods claiming there had been a gun battle when there hadn't. What does that say about this SAS force and indeed others claiming there was a gun battle when there wasn't?
Stephen,
like, what are your thoughts around that?
Well, my thoughts are around that. When I read the evidence of the soldiers from the time, and when the vehicle pulled into the car park, in which there was very little cover for them, and the headlights shone upon the soldiers, there was suggestions that many of them felt that they were being fired upon. So we have to put ourselves in the circumstances of the soldiers that were there that day. You know, again, if you're presented with an anti-aircraft gun facing you and lights shining up your position, how do you react in those circumstances?
No, this was not the spur of the moment thought, as you know, Jonathan.
Well, hold on, Stephen.
The state agencies, claiming afterwards, writing. You're talking about a rewriting into history. The state agencies trying to put on an historical record that there had been a gun battle, and there hadn't. Jonathan,
do you condemn
that? Making stuff up? Do you condemn that?
But there's no conclusive proof. I asked you to look at the aspect of the report where the ballistics expert, which was Mrs. Kernan, she was a ballistics expert brought in terms of this inquest. And she could also say that she couldn't be conclusive that there was no rounds fired by those AK-47s. Now, I don't believe then that there is conclusive evidence to say that they weren't fired upon. I don't believe that there's conclusive evidence to suggest that the soldiers maybe did not feel that they were fired upon. But I do know where the conclusive evidence is. The conclusive evidence is that there was an armed gang of IRA terrorists with an anti-aircraft gun on the back of a vehicle that was intent on taking life.
Okay. Brian, next morning, Brian.
Hello,
morning, Brian.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Stephen, the whole point of this discussion today was how they were shot. They were, what I say, murdered. They could have been apprehended, and that's what's coming out of the report. 800 rounds of ammunition, shot, four shot dead, two shot dead, and in the back running away.
500 runs.
Jonathan Buckley failed to realise that there. And it's proven to people now. And by the way, Stephen, the IRA went out to do harm. I am against violence of any kind of violence. Get that straight. But these professional soldiers waited. SAS. They had umpteen opportunities to apprehend these people. And it's proved to the people where I live that they always denied it, the unionist politicians, shoot to kill. They've done the same in Gibraltar. That comes to mind with me. It's exact same. They could have apprehended the man.
Okay.
But no, what did they do?
Brian, thank you.
They shot them.
Thank you, Brian. Teresa next. Morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'd just like
Mr. Buckley said that the SAS took action to save lives. Okay? Right. They already were aware of this attack taking place. So they were prepared to let it go ahead into collision barracks and shoot down at the barracks to kill people. Does he want us to believe that the police station was full of people and they stood out in the yard and says, come on, boys, take a hit for the SAS is waiting on you up the road? That was planned. The SAS planned the ambush.
So why not arrest them before they launched the attack?
The attack was taking place. They were aware of it. So they let them go into the barracks and say, right, you can shoot away, boys, but we'll get you up the road. John Buckley had realised that, and just when he's changed the subject a few times, has he ever experienced being stopped by the security forces and with a car with children and their father driving, being dragged out of a car and us put along the roadside, car took apart, my father maybe got a kick and walked away laughing and left us to shut the car out again? Did he ever experience that? I'd like to ask him.
How do you feel about the people who were in the IRA that day?
The people in the IRA that day, Jonathan Buckley and them call them terrorists, right? But now they're hitting them to say that was combat.
How do you feel about the people who were in the IRA that day?
Well, the people
were
in the
IRA terrorists in your view?
They were in a war as they saw a war.
So they're in a war?
Yes. These senators were bringing back their own
and if they had have seen a police officer or a soldier lying on the ground, do you think the IRA would have tried to arrest that person in this so-called war? Or do you think they would have shot them in the head? Or do you think they would have shot them in the head and made sure that they achieved a kill?
Well, they're supposed to be as a peacekeeping force, as to stop.
But you're talking about this was a war. So how did the IRA engage in this war if they had the opportunity to kill?
How did Britain engage in a war in any country? How did they
I'm asking about the IRA now.
Yes, but it's a war. But they were saying that it justified. So
you hold a different standard.
If they're in a war. It's justified.
So you hold.
They wanted their country back.
So it's justifiable for the IRA to kill people on site? That's what you're saying.
Soldiers.
Soldiers on
that
site.
That are fighting back with them.
But those soldiers.
Soldiers point the gun at you.
But those soldiers should never have fired a bullet. Is that right?
Sorry?
But the soldiers should never have fired a bullet. Is that right?
There should be no war. There should be nothing. There wouldn't be any trouble here if Britain would
stay
in their own corner.
Back then,
yes, Britain came in here. They admitted Britain started the whole thing.
So am I just right in this, Theresa? Just so that I'm sure of your thinking. You're saying that the IRA on that day were entitled to shoot and kill as much as they wanted to, but the soldiers should not have shot anybody. Is that what you're saying?
No, the soldiers knew this attack was taking place.
Yeah.
They should have knew. Okay. They knew. They let the incident happen.
Okay.
Nobody else
Thank you very much. And of course, many people would be saying the forces of the state should be absolutely of a higher standard than people in the IRA. Thanks to Jonathan Buckley this morning and to Alban McGuinness. 03030 80 55 55. Today marks 4 weeks since Storm Owen. First time that Ireland, the island of Ireland, Northern Ireland, had a red weather warning. Much of the devastation of the aftermath has been clear, but there are still some people throughout Northern Ireland who are still without internet and telephone connections. I've been speaking to the DUP MLA, Chair of the Infrastructure Committee, Deborah Erskine, and I started by asking her about the long wait for some customers to have their internet service restored.
Absolutely sick, sore and tired of it, Stephen, at this stage. Internet and our telecoms is now just part of our daily life, and we're so reliant on it. Customers and constituents of mine who've been affected since the 23rd of January are now at breaking point with it. And I mean, if you cast your mind back, this day 4 weeks ago, people were waking up, and like myself, I was cut off from the entire world, it would seem, with no mobile network, no broadband, no electricity, and in some cases, no water. And so to be 4 weeks on and without proper telecoms going through to your home is really frustrating.
And what is the issue here? Like, what is going on?
Well, I mean, I have spoken to Fibres. I know at the start it was obviously trying to get NIE connections up and going, but that is now passed. We're now in a space where I think in some cases Fibres were also waiting on Openreach to repair some of the infrastructure because they shared some of that. But Stephen, I'm also going to say I think it's down to resource as well and having boots on the ground to actually helping and get people up and going again. But we shouldn't be in this space 4 weeks on. And I really, really, I have to say, I'm disappointed, Stephen, that I raised an urgent oral question on the 3rd of February to try and get the minister to deal with this. And since then, there has been silence on this. I mean, I even looked on the economy website today just to see, had there been any news put out, any urgent meeting with telecoms companies? There's been none.
Well, you're having a pop with the minister, but this is not a devolved issue, is it? Telecommunications is not devolved.
No, it's not devolved. But the Department of Economy has a relationship with Fibrous, the Department of Economy could call in these companies. They're multi-million pound companies, Stephen. I have people who are still paying their bills 4 weeks on from having no service whatsoever. That's unacceptable. And I think, regardless, as a government in Stormont, we have to show people that we're serious about trying to deal with their problems. And the minister has not taken on board, in my view, the real need that there is to get this issue sorted out urgently for people. We're talking about businesses here. We're talking about self-employed. We're talking about elderly people. I mean, I had a scenario in which elderly people who have the wee wrist buttons that go around their arms were unable to make emergency communications with their family, with people. And that's not a good situation to be in. I've had people who have had to travel distances to get internet connection. That should not be. Those people have been out money. They've been out time. They're frustrated. And it is, comms are a critical part of our daily life, Stephen. And I think we need to treat it with the seriousness that it deserves and that it needs. And I would have thought, yes, we have the Department of Economy is obviously working with DSIT and was working in relation to the Electronic Communications and Resilience Response Group within the Civil Contingencies Division in the Executive Office. But why not bring these companies in, find out what went wrong, get learning from this, and then try and see what we can do to solve the issues?
Well, look, you're the chair of the Infrastructure Committee, aren't you? So do yes. you know, like, what is Fibre saying in terms of when these people will have their internet restored?
Well, Stephen, although I am chair of the Infrastructure Committee, this actually falls under the Economy Department.
But you say, you say, Deborah, that you've spoken to Fibrous. Have they given you any indication as to when this will be resolved?
So there are still people out. I mean, from Tuesday, there were still 410 customers in Fermanagh and South Tyrone were still out. Now, that number has decreased, and I know that from the communication that I've had with constituents that were on my list. The main areas that were still affected at that stage were Enniskillen, Kesh and Irvinstown. At the peak on the 3rd of February, there were 6,000, and those were mainly in Fermanagh, South Tyrone and in Mid Ulster. Now, I know that there has also been the need to get road closures in place from Fibrous point of view to ensure, obviously, health and safety of their staff, being able to put up lines and one thing and another. Now, I understand from my communications with Fibrous that the Department of Infrastructure in that case worked very well with them to try and get all of those in place. But I think, Stephen, this does fall down to resourcing. I also feel that the communication with customers has been deplorable. I had customers who were only getting a text message from Fibrous, that was when they did have network, on the 3rd of February, after I had done my urgent oral question, sat down, I then had constituents who were getting in touch straight away with me to tell me I'm only getting my restoration date now. But what I do know, Stephen, is we are pushing this. The DUP is pushing this. My colleague, Philip Brett, who sits on the Economy Committee, is bringing Fibrous to the Economy Committee. We need to learn from this storm. We need to ensure that things like this do not happen again, that our constituents who have been put out in terms of their business, in terms of their daily lives, in terms of their work, in terms of money, all of that, have that voice that is trying to push to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Okay. Deborah, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. Thank you. Fibrous are saying sorry. They say, look, that they've fixed over 90% of customers who were out of service as a result of the storm. They say in rural areas they're facing additional challenges such as secondary damages to the network, damage to third-party infrastructure, and that they are doing their very best. Stephen has contacted this morning. Or Stefan or Stephen? Morning.
Stephen, same as you, just with an A. Yeah.
Just Stephen. We'll give you the fancier Stefan. So you were out. You've just been reconnected in the last few days. But what was it like to be out for as long? How long were you out?
We had no internet connection at all from the Thursday evening, the 23rd, right through till just after 7 p.m. on Wednesday evening there with engineers.
Oh, long time.
So we had no telephone or no connection at all. Yes.
What did that feel like?
Very, very difficult because you're so much used to using the internet and all for communication to people and all and it's just you got used to it eventually, right enough, but I ended up and all every day or so, every couple of days I went down to the local library just to check emails and all.
Yeah, we're so reliant now, aren't we?
That's right.
We are so reliant on online stuff. So do you think Fibres did the best they could? Were you appreciative or disappointed in their service?
Well, as far as goes the engineers and all, you know, it wasn't an easy operation for them because there's still some roads, believe it or not, yet blocked because an engineer was chatting to me on Wednesday. They were saying that there's still some roads they can't get access to, public roads, because with three still falling.
Patsy McGlone, the SLP MLA for Mid-Ulster. Morning to you, Patsy.
Good morning, Stephen.
Well, there were loads of customers affected in your area, Patsy.
Oh, yes, and listen to Deborah earlier there. It's much a similar sort of situation in Mid-Ulster here, albeit we have, on Tuesday, there was 152 people without service, most of whom are, well, obviously all of those 152 are Fibres customers. It's just to clarify a point, considerable investment was made in Project Stratum. Some of the money, 150 million, came from the confidence and supply arrangement with the DUP, but the rest of it was topped up with various inputs up to 189 million from different departments, including the Department for the Economy and DERA. Now, the Department for the Economy is the oversight management department for Project Stratum, which was rolling out to 81,000 homes, principally in rural areas, a broadband project. So, why I'm saying that is, I'm painting the picture. I'm on the Agriculture, Environment, Rural Affairs Committee. I've already suggested that we have a joint meeting of both committees, that's Agriculture, Environment, Rural Affairs, and Economy. Economy has oversight. Agriculture pumped millions into this project as well, with Fibres, to see just what exactly is going wrong here. Because by this stage, a month later, people should be expecting to have their service reinstated and have it up and running again, especially those who... Because we tend to look at broadband, you say that's for your internet, for your emails and whatever. But in many instances, the landline has now switched over to use of broadband.
That's right.
As opposed to what it was before. And there are people who work from home who require broadband as well for their...
And there are elderly people with their emergency buttons around their neck.
Absolutely.
That, you know, if they fall or trip, communication with the outside world is through the internet. Patsy, thank you. Good to hear from you this morning. Thank you for talking to us, Stephen.
Thank
you as well. Here comes the 10 o'clock news from the BBC. Right, we understand Sinn Féin are about to hold a press conference in Dublin. Our political editor, Enda McClafferty, joining us now. Enda, what's going on?
Yes, Stephen. Sinn Féin are going to announce this morning that the party will not be attending the White House reception or going to Washington for the St. Patrick's Day events next month. That means that party leader, party president Mary Lou McDonald will not be making the trip, nor indeed will the First Minister Michelle O'Neill be making the trip to Washington this year. There's a press conference due to start in Dublin very shortly. The Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou McDonald, has just taken to Twitter to post a statement on Twitter, obviously now X, to explain the party's decision around this, and basically setting out how what has happened over the course of the past number of months in relation to Donald Trump's presidency, what he has said over the course of the past week in relation to Ukraine and Vladimir Zelensky, basically saying that he started the war and that he is a dictator. That hasn't gone down well, as you know. Mary Lou McDonald saying that's one of the reasons why her party is now taking this position, and also the US government's approach to Gaza and what is happening there, and the comments previously made by Donald Trump about the US's role now in terms of what's going to happen next in Gaza. For those reasons, Mary Lou McDonald is saying that her party is now not going to be taking part in the St. Patrick's Day festivities in Washington.
We'll take some of the press conference here this morning, which is about to start, if we can. And this not only then focuses on Sinn Féin not going, it puts a focus on who from Northern Ireland will go.
Yes, that's right, Stephen. And the focus now will fall to whether or not the Deputy First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly, will make the journey. She was questioned, in fact, in the Stormont Chamber earlier this week about whether or not the First and Deputy First Ministers would be making the trip. She says, as yet, there's been no formal invitation issued. And she said that it was still very much a matter under consideration. Now, what will happen now is obviously it'll be down to her to decide whether she goes and represents Northern Ireland as Deputy First Minister. Even though it's a joint office, she can do that, Stephen, as long as it's not vetoed by the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill. So there is a pathway by which Emma Little-Pengelly could well end up in Washington representing Northern Ireland, and I would hazard a guess to say that is the likely outcome of all of this.
Well, although Michelle O'Neill has the power to stop Emma Little-Pengelly going as a representative of the executive office, is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is how the office operates, Stephen. It is a joint office. One can't, in a sense, operate in isolation from the other. So in a sense, one needs the other's permission to be able to go and represent the executive office. So as long as Michelle O'Neill doesn't, in a sense, veto any potential trip to the US by the Deputy First Minister, then Emma Little-Pengelly will be able to go there and represent Northern Ireland.
It asks the question, Enda, that if Sinn Féin are so passionate about this, why wouldn't they use their veto to stop the executive office being represented?
Well, I think this is very much a political decision, Stephen, and I think we have to read into the fact that this announcement is being made in Dublin today and not, in a sense, being made in Belfast when it involves Northern Ireland's First Minister. And I think very much the party feel that this politically is the right thing to do for Sinn Féin as a party, not to travel to the US given what is happening in the wider political landscape right now. And I think by the very fact that if it happens that Deputy First Minister Emma Little-Pengelly is able to go to Washington, is able to represent Northern Ireland, that in a sense limits some of the criticism that might well be fired at Sinn Féin and the First Minister Michelle O'Neill in terms of Northern Ireland not having a critical voice in the corridors of power at such a key time, because we know, of course, the opportunity that St Patrick's Day celebrations present to the parties, and you could see the criticism that will be coming down the track, not least from business leaders, if Northern Ireland is not represented. So I think by the very fact that Emma Little-Pengelly could find herself over there, in a sense, might deflect some of the political pressure away from Michelle O'Neill and taking this what is a party decision, obviously.
Yeah. But it will mean the questions, if Emma Little-Pengelly does go, questions will be fired at the DUP. What do they think about what Donald Trump has said about Zelensky? Donald Trump pronouncing that Zelensky started the war and all that comes with it. There'll be many questions around that. Mary Lou McDonald, I think, is just walking to the podium now. And sorry, go ahead, Aunt Michelle.
Yes. But we do know, of course, that the DUP has already, in a sense, been out fighting that fire. We heard from Gavin Robinson, also from the DUP MP Sammy Wilson, basically saying that, well, they support the Trump administration. They don't agree with everything that he has said, not least what he said about Ukraine. The DUP says it stands firm behind President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Let's just hear from Mary Lou McDonald. This is live from Dublin.
I followed with growing concern what's happening on the ground in Gaza and the West Bank, and like many other Irish people, have listened in horror to calls from the President of the United States for the mass expulsion of the Palestinian people from their homes and the permanent seizure of Palestinian lands. Such an approach is a fundamental breach of international law, is deeply destabilising to the Middle East, and a dangerous departure from the UN position of peace and security for Palestine and Israel, and the right of Palestinians to self-determination. The ties between Ireland and the United States are historic and they run deep. There are deep bonds between Sinn Féin and the people of the United States who supported peace and prosperity in Ireland. These relationships are valuable and enduring. The US is a valued friend of Ireland, and their work in helping to achieve the Good Friday Agreement stands as a clear example of successful US foreign policy. They are an important player for peace in Ireland, and continue to play a strong role in the Irish economy. And of course, St. Patrick's Day each year is an important moment to reinforce all of those connections. But there is also an onus on us to speak honestly and to act when we believe the US administration is wrong, catastrophically so in the case of Palestine. So I've thought deeply about this issue in recent days. I've listened to many, many voices inside and outside of Sinn Féin. And I've made the decision not to attend events in the White House this year as a principled stance against the call for the mass expulsion of the Palestinian people from Gaza, something which I believe demands serious dissent and serious objection. The only route to peace and security is a permanent ceasefire, followed by a negotiated settlement that guarantees peace and security for both Palestinians and Israelis through a just and sustainable two-state solution. And that should be the position of the United States. Sinn Féin will continue to engage with the US administration at various levels, with Friends of Ireland on Capitol Hill, with the trade union movement and business leaders, both in the United States and here in Ireland. We'll continue our relentless work for a future of peace, progress, stability and prosperity. An Taoiseach will attend the White House for his bilateral engagement with the United States President. It is he who represents the Irish people and will have the opportunity to speak on behalf of Ireland when he meets the American President. He must use this opportunity to reflect the view of the Irish people in relation to Palestine, in support of international law, and to absolutely reject threats for the mass expulsion of the Palestinian people and the seizure of their land. We will brief members of the International Diplomatic Corps here in Dublin later this morning and business leaders north and south in the coming week. Michelle.
Good morning, everybody. I also have taken the decision as First Minister not to attend events in the White House this year. The decision to not travel to the White House has not been taken lightly, but it is taken very conscious of the responsibility that each of us have as individuals to call out injustice
when we see it. We are all heartbroken whenever we witness the suffering of the Palestinian people. And the recent comments by the US President around the mass expulsion of the Palestinian people from Gaza is just simply something that I cannot ignore. I have travelled to the US on many of occasions. I have to seek support for peace, for our economy, and particularly in the face of Brexit. I've met with senior figures on Capitol Hill, I've met with successive US presidents, and I've always spoken passionately and honestly, and I will always do so. I am fully aware of the positive impact that the US has had, because we've experienced it in Ireland. North and South, it has had a transformational impact. So I will continue to engage with the US both politically and economically. But at times like this, people look towards political leaders to stand against injustice. So in the future, whenever our children and our grandchildren ask us, what did we do while the Palestinian people endured unimaginable suffering? I can say firmly that I stood on the side of humanity. Thank you, folks.
Well, that's Michelle O'Neill. The First Minister, saying she is not attending as the First Minister of Northern Ireland. It does lend itself to, will Sinn Féin use their veto to stop Northern Ireland being represented in terms of the executive office? And your reaction to what you've heard there?
Well, Stephen, as we expected, this sort of news started to develop late last night and now crystallised in terms of what the Sinn Féin position is going to do. I suppose no great surprise given what's happened over the course of the past week. Interesting to note that a lot of it was framed around what was happening in Gaza. We know that there was great resistance from Sinn Féin to the previous American administration to what happened in Gaza. They came under pressure last year but opted not to boycott the White House events last year, said they were going in pursuit of peace. This time, of course, different president in place and the party is now taking what it would be a tougher stand by not going to take part in what's happening next month.
And Emma Claffery, thank you very much. Former Sinn Féin election candidate, commentator Chris Donnelly with us this morning. Chris, we've a short period of time here. Thank you for waiting for us. Should Sinn Féin use their veto to stop the executive office, to stop Emma Little-Pengelly attending?
Well, ultimately, that's their call. I don't think, personally, I don't really think they will. I mean, this is Sinn Féin making their own statement, saying, you heard, we covered the press conference there, Mary Lou McDonald, Michelle O'Neill, saying that really this is about Gaza. This is about what has happened over the last year. But I think ultimately what this is about is how Trump lionized Benjamin Netanyahu, bringing him to the White House, and then shockingly declaring his desire to ethnically cleanse Gaza Palestinians and lay claim to that land for America. So it's, you know, we're seeing Trump, the Trump presidency is very young, but it's a paradigm shifting moment. You know, he's provoking controversy across the globe, comments about taking over Greenland, the Panama Canal. He's caused uproar amongst Canadians. But this, for Sinn Féin, it's this, it's Gaza. It's what we've been witnessing. And then it's the treatment of Benjamin Netanyahu, bring him to the White House and making those shocking comments about ethnically cleansing Gaza.
Chris Donnelly, thank you. There'll be more on this throughout the day here on BBC Radio Ulster. Our last story of the day, we hear almost daily about the pressures on the healthcare system, but what about the reality of those caught up in it? Kirk contacted the Nolan Show after his brother-in-law, Keith, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at 60. Soon became clear that he needed full-time care in a care home setting. But after a violent outburst, Keith is now effectively homeless and being kept in hospital because no suitable accommodation is being found. Kirk told me about Keith.
Keith is 62 years of age. He moved back to Northern Ireland. He's born in Northern Ireland and lived in Bangor, but he's lived in England for about nearly 40 years. Moved back at the start of lockdown, and for a short time he lived with us over lockdown, but then at the end of lockdown he bought his own house. Now, there was his behaviour at that stage seemed to be strange, but we didn't really put a finger on it. But there were incidents that happened that made us realise there's something not right, but he wasn't actually diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's until 2021.
Okay.
When he was,
and were there little signs in between that you were thinking, what's he doing this for? Why is he doing this?
Yeah, there were.
Like what?
When he lived with us, for instance, one day I was. It sounds very trivial, but I was wiring in a new cooker in the kitchen, new cooker, old cooker, all over the kitchen floor, and Keith comes in and decides I'm going to make my tea. And couldn't see past the fact that he needed to make his tea and the fact that I was working there and the cooker wasn't working.
Sure.
Didn't seem to register with him. Probably the worst incident that we had with Keith was, and this is what sort of drove us to get the diagnosis. At that stage, he had his own house. He was still driving. And he on impulse, he just decided he was going to go over to England. Because to the southeast, as he called it, because he lived in Kent when he was there. And he just announced this when he was on his way down to the ferry to us. Went over to Cairn Ran, but instead of driving down south, he ended up in Glasgow. And fortunately, we have family in Scotland and we were able to navigate him to his aunt's house.
That was a big warning sign then.
Kurt. Yeah.
So you knew at that stage, look, there's something wrong here, and you got a diagnosis,
yes,
of early onset Alzheimer's.
Yes.
How quickly did he deteriorate after that?
Well, they did tell us that for somebody to be diagnosed at his age, it would progress more rapidly than it would with an older person. But he was on medication and he managed to look after himself for quite a while. But then there was he got lost on one occasion, ended up at midnight in Saintfield. Now he lived in Newnards. We don't know how he ended up in Saintfield. The people, he basically rapped somebody's door and said, I'm lost at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
The police got involved, got him home. and they made contact with us the next day. And there was a there's a protocol called the Herbert Protocol, which was then set up, and all case details, photograph, etc., were with them. But he managed. He had a care package. He had a respite care coming in, took him out twice a week.
He deteriorated to the point he needed to go into a care home.
Well, basically, he went missing. I think it was the end of November. About last weekend, November.
And he was found walking along the motorway.
He was found walking along the hard shoulder of the motor, the M1 of Stockman's Lane.
Wow, okay.
And the police got him home. He's been missing for quite some time, but what we didn't realise when we were first made aware, which was about 9 o'clock at night, that he had in fact left the house at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's when the last time anybody had any contact with him.
So he needed to go into the care home for his own safety, clearly. Yep. First couple of weeks, everything's going great.
Everything was fine.
What happened?
His behaviour started to change. And he actually attacked a young lad, 20-year-old, coming in to visit his grandmother, which was totally out of character for Keith, because he's not and never has been a violent person or had a violent nature. Now, that was all resolved. The young lad, although he's very startled, accepted what had happened, and the staff sort of kept their eye on Keith. And over the next few days, although his behaviour had become a little more erratic, let's say, or strange, he was walking about following the staff and the home. But there was no further outbursts of any violence of any sort until the Wednesday morning, when at 5:30 he got up and he pulled a sink on the top off the wall.
My goodness.
In the toilet.
Right.
He attacked two members of staff. We only found out just this week that, in fact, the reason that he pulled the top off the wall was because he thought the place was on fire. And he pulled the top off the wall and flooded the immediate area around it, because he thought it would put the fire out. He was walking round the home, lifting his feet as if he was trying to stamp the fire out. But having said all that, we don't know why he attacked the staff. He had two members of staff who had to, for safety, lock themselves into, I think it was a nurse's station. He was banging on doors, kicking doors. So they called the police, and rightly so. And the police got him in and calmed down. But when the police sort of went off site very briefly, is the violence flared up again. So they took him to, they agreed to take him to the Royal. The police didn't go with him. There was no staff available to go, but the paramedics were satisfied that they would be able to look after him, and they did. There was one guy, actually a junior paramedic, trainee paramedic, I say junior, he's in his 30s, but he managed to talk Keith down. Keith is very, very passionate about music. He's a fantastic drummer. He's drummed all his life. And he managed to get a bit of rapport with Keith, and he was fine going on the journey over. And we got a phone call about 1:15 on the Wednesday afternoon from a nurse who said to Anne, my wife, would you speak to your brother, Keith, because he wants to leave here and we have no powers to prevent them from leaving. And she asked the question, has he been on his own? And said, yes. And says, well, he went there because there was supposed to be security there, so he could be supervised, and that didn't happen. But anyway.
So what were they saying? Were they saying, look, did they want him out of the hospital?
Yeah, basically. They said, once I take the needle out of his arm here, I have no power to keep him here. And both Anne and I were speaking to the nurse on a speakerphone, and I said, you must not let Keith leave. And I explained the circumstances. He's got Alzheimer's. He has been assessed, and it has been said that he's not fit to live on his own. I explained again all what had happened that day in the home. And she says, yeah, we're aware of all that. I said, well, then you can't let him go. He says, well, we don't have the power. If he says he wants to leave, we have no power to stop him.
My goodness. So someone with Alzheimer's that doesn't have the capacity to be making rational decisions was going to be walking out the door of that hospital, walking on the what? On another motorway, attacking people in the middle of the street, doing what?
Exactly, in an area which he didn't know.
Could you get him back to that care home and get him proper supervision in it that he had left?
No, we couldn't do that because the care home manager, and I have to say we both supported her point of view, that he couldn't return there because he had a duty of care to her staff and her residents. So he ended up in a critical care ward and he's still there.
He's still in hospital?
He's still in hospital. He's been there for 4 weeks.
On what type of medication?
I should have said that he had been sedated as soon as he went in on the Wednesday. So he was given a medication, lorazepam.
And is he still being sedated?
Yes, as far as I know, he is. He's still being sedated.
So rather than Keith being given proper accommodation in a specialist care home, he's being sedated in a hospital.
Yes.
So he's caught in the system. What's happening to him now?
He's still in the system.
He's still in that room in the hospital?
He's still in that room in a hospital in a critical care unit.
What do you want to happen?
What we want to happen is for them to find somewhere to go. Because of the decisions that have been made by medical staff at the Royal, he is now homeless. Because the care home were prepared to take him back when they realised he was on medication. Well, they knew that he was on medication.
Yeah.
Somebody, I'm saying the hospital, but somebody made the decision that they wouldn't do that.
Okay. Well, look.
So the home then had no option but to discharge him from his room.
So here's how the Trust are responding. They say they understand the anxiety and frustration that Mr. Murray's family is experiencing while we try to secure a care home placement for him. Mr. Murray's care needs are very complex and we're currently trying to identify a home which can provide the level of care he requires. Currently, there's very limited availability of care home beds for older people with complex care needs and we regret that this has created further delays for Mr. Murray. We will continue in our efforts to resolve this issue and we'll keep his family informed. So in other words, out of that statement, they're saying they can't find a place for him and they don't know when they're going to be able to find one by.
Yes. Well, it's interesting to say that they'll keep the family informed because they have not made any, other than the phone call we got from the nurse on the Wednesday he was admitted to hospital, we haven't had one communication other than through the social worker at the hospital, as you'd say.
What's your fear here?
Well, my fear, to be honest, we obviously have visited him. I think that he has deteriorated very badly since this whole episode began 4 weeks ago.
Well, he's not in the place he should be. We know that because the Trust is saying he needs a secure care home placement. So we'll stay across this. That's what we can do. And you keep in contact with us. He's 4 weeks in now. The Trust say they're currently trying to find a home. So let's see how quickly they can do that. You stay in touch with us. We'll stay in touch with you and let's stay on it.
That's fine, Stephen. Right, I do appreciate it.
Thank you for telling us through the story.
Indeed.
Thank you. And that's about it from us for today. That was a busy show this morning. I'm on 5 Live tonight, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, over on 5 Live, where we start at 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock on a Saturday. Or we'll see you back here on BBC Radio Ulster at 9 a.m. Thank you very much for another week. Look after yourselves. See you Monday. Bye-bye.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.